wasn't much they didn't know about the outside environment of the compound. In Washington, President Obama and his advisors were still discussing different options. The president still had not signed off on the ground assault option. All we had been authorized to do up to now was to start planning and conduct rehearsals. The White House was still considering an Air Force option, a massive airstrike using B-2 Spirit bombers to level the house. Defense Secretary Robert Gates supported the airstrike because it kept American ground forces out of Pakistan, which made the mission less like an invasion of the country's sovereignty. The United States didn't have a great track record when it came to commando raids like the one we were planning. Since Operation Eagle Claw, there was a lot of risk in putting troops in harm's way in a sovereign country. During Eagle Claw, one of six helicopters flying to a desert staging base in Iran before the raid hit a fierce sand cloud and crashed into an MC-130E containing fuel. The fire destroyed both aircraft and killed 8 servicemen. The mission, one of the first operations conducted by Delta Force, was aborted. Eagle Claw was a disaster and contributed to Carter losing his re-election campaign. The airstrike option required 32 2,000-pound smart bombs. The barrage would last for a full minute and a half, and the crater would penetrate at least 30 feet into the earth in case the compound had a bunker system. The possibility for collateral damage was high, and the possibility of finding identifiable remains after that kind of destruction was low. If we were going to conduct this mission, either with an airstrike or raid, they wanted proof it was bin Laden. The assault was risky, but the airstrike added additional complications. A few days after we arrived in North Carolina, we saw the Pacer for the first time. Standing around the computer screen, we watched drone footage of the compound. The feed was black and white, with little detail. I could make out the main building and the courtyard that took up the northeastern part of the compound. After a few seconds, I saw the Pacer enter the frame. From the video feed, he looked like an ant. There was no way we could make out his face or even how tall he was. But we could see him walk out of the north door and start pacing in an oval clockwise around the courtyard. A makeshift awning was rigged up to cover him, but it only shaded part of the garden. "He does this for hours," one of the agency analysts said. "I've seen him walk by guys doing work, but he never helps. He just paces." Sometimes he walked with a female or a child. None of them stopped to do any work. When a veterinarian came to treat the cow that lived in the courtyard, they moved it to another courtyard for treatment. "We believe the reason they moved the cow is they don't want anyone to see that side of the compound," the analyst said. "It's circumstantial, but it looks like they are hiding someone. Hey, take a look at this." Clicking to another day's feed, we could see the compound, and then from the right side of the screen, a Pakistani helicopter flew over. "Where did that come from?" I said. "A Pac-Mil Huey," the analyst said. "Not sure where it came from, but it was leaving the military academy." We all stared at the screen, waiting to see if anyone in the compound reacted. We didn't see the Pacer sprint to a car and run. Instantly, we all thought the same thing. This meant he was accustomed to hearing helicopters. "We might actually be able to get on the deck before they really figure out what is going on," Charlie said. With the mission planned out, we began rehearsals. The Blackhawks swooped over the North Carolina pine forest and came to a hover over the compound. From my perch, sitting, legs blowing in the breeze just outside the left door of the helicopter, I could see the life-size mock-up of bin Laden's compound. Nestled in a remote part of the base, the practice compound was built to scale using plywood, chain-link fence, and shipping containers. Sliding down the fast rope, I landed in the courtyard and moved to the double doors at C1. All around me, my teammates were racing to their objectives. The roar of the engines above us made it hard to talk, but after 3 days of practice, we didn't need to talk. The whole mission had become muscle memory. Besides some time hacks that were called out over the radio, the net was silent. Everyone knew their individual jobs. We had years and years of experience among the groups, so everything moved smoothly. This target wasn't any more complicated than hundreds of others we'd assaulted over the years. The rehearsals were less about training and more about selling to the White House that we could do it. The level of detail on the mock-up was impressive. The construction crews at the base had planted trees, dug a ditch around the compound, and even put in mounded dirt to simulate the potato fields that surrounded the compound in Pakistan. After a few runs, we asked if they could add the third-floor balcony and move some of the gates to better simulate the layout of the actual compound. Before the next rehearsal, the changes were made. The construction crew didn't ask why and never said no. They just showed up and made all requested changes. We'd never been treated like this. All of the bureaucracy was gone. If we needed something, we got it. No questions asked. It was a far cry from what we were forced to deal with in Afghanistan. The only black hole in the practice compound was the interiors. We had no idea what the inside of the house looked like. It wasn't a big concern. We had years of combat experience and we could apply it to this problem. We had no doubt we could pull this off. We just needed to get on the ground. Stopping at the door of the container that simulated C-1, I scanned inside before entering. During the real mission, I had no idea if Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti would be armed or if he had a suicide vest. We anticipated all of the men, bin Laden, Khalid, and the two Kuwaiti brothers, would fight back. After we rehearsed the best-case scenario, we started running through the contingencies. Instead of roping into the courtyard, we landed outside the walls and raided the compound from there. We also practiced tracking down squirters if someone ran from the target before the assault. Every single contingency was practiced to the point where we were tired of it. We had never trained this much for a particular objective before in our lives. But it was important. The mission was straightforward, but the extra preparation helped us mesh since we'd been drawn from different teams. After the last rehearsals, we all met in the operations center. Jay was there with an update. We're headed home, and then Monday we head out west for another week of training and a full mission profile, he said. I raised my hand. Do we have any official word if this thing is approved yet or not? I said. Nope, he said. Still waiting on Washington. I looked at Walt. His eyes rolled. It was the hurry-up-and-wait routine we had experienced with the Captain Phillips operation. My money says we don't launch, Walt said as we left. We flew out to our training site early Monday. On Thursday, almost 2 weeks after we got the initial tasking, we had our dress rehearsal. The entire team and all the planners gathered in a massive hangar at the base. On the floor was a map of eastern Afghanistan. A group of VIPs, headlined by Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Admiral Eric Olson, commander of the Special Operations Command in Tampa and a former DEVGRU commander, sat in stands near the map with Vice Admiral Bill McCraven. McCraven is commanded at every level within the special operations community, including DEVGRU. He impressed me. McCraven, the 3-star admiral atop the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, was tall, lean, and clean-cut. Most admirals look old or out of shape, but McCraven looked like he could still get the job done. He knew how to work his level and had a good handle on the politics in D.C. We were about to execute what was called a rock drill, and everything from helicopter flight paths to the mock-up of the compound was present on the floor. A narrator reading off a script started the hour-and-a-half-long brief on Operation Neptune Spear. The pilots spoke first. They walked everyone through the flight path from Jalalabad to the compound in Abbottabad. They talked about the radio calls, as well as any contingencies that might arise in flight. Finally, each assault team leader got up and briefed their individual tasks. My team will fast rope from Chalk 1 into the courtyard. We'll clear and secure C-1, then backfill the rest of the teams in A-1, I said. Most of the questions from the VIPs focused on the perimeter team. There were a lot of concerns about how our external security would handle onlookers. What is your plan if you're confronted by local police or military? They asked the team leader. Sir, we will de-escalate if at all possible, he said, first using the interpreter, then using the dog, and then visible lasers. As a last resort, we will use force. Toward the end, a question was raised about whether or not this was a kill mission. A lawyer from either the Department of Defense or the White House made it clear this wasn't an assassination. If he is naked with his hands up, you're not going to engage him, he told us. I am not going to tell you how to do your job. What we're saying is, if he does not pose a threat, you will detain him. After the brief, we loaded up into the helicopters and took off for one final run-through. We were going to assault a mock compound so the VIPs could watch. It was the final hurdle. I knew we had to do it, but it felt strange to be watched like this. It felt like we were in a fishbowl. We all agreed if jumping through these hoops was going to help us get approval, the hassle was worth it. 1 minute from the target, the crew chief threw open the door and I swung my legs out. Grabbing the rope, I could see some VIPs near the target staring up at us with night vision goggles. As the helicopter started its hover over our fast rope location, the rotors kicked up a maelstrom of rocks and dust, blasting the VIPs and forcing them to run in the opposite direction. I chuckled as I watched a few of the women stagger away on their heels. The rehearsal went off without an issue on our end. "So you think we'll get the go-ahead?" Charlie asked me after the dress rehearsal. "Dude, I've got no clue," I said. "I'm not holding my breath." The flight back the next day was low-key. We were ready to go. There was nothing we could do now but wait. Chapter 11. Killing Time. The sun was fading as I flashed my ID card to the guard at our base in Virginia Beach. He saw my decal as I pulled closer and waved me through. I passed a long line of cars heading home for the day. I was a few hours early for our flight, but I was tired of waiting. It had been a long week at home. When we are home too long, we get antsy. It was Easter, and I called my parents to check in. We caught up, but I couldn't tell them what I was really doing. While the rest of America was coloring Easter eggs, we were sitting on the biggest secret of our lives. After the dress rehearsal out west, it all came down to the politicians in Washington making a decision. We made one more trip to North Carolina to conduct a last walkthrough of the compound before returning to find out we'd finally gotten orders to move forward and stage in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. We were all still very skeptical. Nobody was jumping up and down. Everybody digested the news in their own way and went about their business. At least we were one step closer to actually roping into the compound. I parked my truck and grabbed my backpack. I could see some of my teammates walking toward the headquarters. I'm sure we all had the same thoughts running through our minds. Holy shit, I can't believe they actually approved this. I think most of us were convinced there was no way this was actually going to happen. In a way, it's a defense mechanism. That way, if it got turned off at the last minute, we wouldn't be too upset. "Yeah, whatever. I'll believe it when we're airborne," Walt said, walking with me into the lobby of the building. "This has a good chance if they're actually sending us over," I said. By moving us, they risked more and more leaks. The rest of our command definitely knew something was going on. Even a troop movement of this relatively small size could cause spikes when a bunch of operators came through Bagram on a non-scheduled rotation. Inside the team room, guys were eating a last-minute snack before the long flight. Some just stood around talking. We were all dressed in jeans and button-up collared shirts, our normal travel attire. We looked like a bunch of guys going on vacation. If we'd been carrying golf clubs instead of rifles and night vision goggles, you might mistake us for a professional sports team. Other than my equipment for the raid itself, I was traveling light, with only a few changes of clothes, my shower kit, and flip-flops. We weren't staying long. The plan was to fly over, spend 2 days getting acclimated, and conduct the mission on the third night. Buses soon took us from our base to a nearby airport. On the tarmac sat a massive gray C-17 Globemaster. Its engines idled as the Air Force crew did pre-flight checks. Already on board were the helicopter mechanics. Nearby, a group of National Security Agency and CIA analysts kept to themselves. As we sat down, it felt comfortable, like a place we'd been many times before. This was the same way we always went on deployment. Inside the belly of the aircraft, our equipment and the helicopter crew's tools were strapped to the deck. Seats lined the walls. I threw my backpack on the deck and fished out my nylon green jungle hammock. Looking around the cargo bay for a place to hang it, I saw my teammates crawling around the plane like ants looking for a comfortable spot to stretch out. We were experts in making the flight as comfortable as possible. I attached my hammock between two containers holding gear. Other guys claim spots on top of containers or in the open space between the seats and the cargo. Some of my teammates pumped up camping mattresses, but I was one of the few who used the hammock. It was issued to us for jungle missions, but I liked that it kept me off the cold floor. We had a 9-hour flight to Germany, and after a short layover, another 8 hours to get to Bagram. Getting as much sleep as we could on the flight was imperative. The Air Force crew chased us back to our seats to strap in just before takeoff. The only open seat was next to Jen, a CIA analyst. Slipping the buckle of my seatbelt into the clasp, I felt the plane start to taxi to the end of the runway. Minutes later, we raced down the tarmac and quickly climbed into the sky. Once we were level, guys started to pop Ambien and settle in for the long flight. I wasn't tired, so I started to talk with Jen. I'd seen her around in North Carolina, but we hadn't gotten to talk at length since we started planning the operation. I was curious to get her take on things, since she was one of the leading analysts that helped in the hunt for bin Laden. "Honestly," I asked Jen, "what are the odds it's him?"
100%, she shot back, almost defiant.
Recruited by the agency out of college, she'd been working on the bin Laden task force for the last 5 years. Analysts rotated in and out of the task force, but she stayed and kept after it. After the al-Kuwaiti phone call, she'd worked to put all the pieces together. I missed the first day's brief, where Jen laid out how they tracked him to Abbottabad. In the weeks since, she had been our go-to analyst on all intelligence questions regarding the target. We'd heard the 100% call in the past, and each time, it made my stomach hurt.
"Be careful with that shit," I said. "When our intel folks say it is 100%, it is more like 10. When they say 10%, it is more like 100.
She smiled, undeterred. No, Jen said. 100%.
100% like in 2007, I said.
Like me, she remembered 2007, when we'd been spun up to chase the guy in white flowing robes. Jen rolled her eyes and frowned.
"That wasn't a good lead," she said, even though the lead had come from a CIA source. "That whole thing spun out of control quickly."
It was nice to hear the CIA take even some of the blame, although you could pretty much throw a stick in 2007 and hit someone responsible for that debacle. That mission had been weighed down by the typical problem of everybody wanting to be involved. Already, the differences between 2007 and now were apparent, which lent more credibility to the current mission. Jen wasn't afraid to share her opinion with even the highest officers, including Vice Admiral McCraven. She had made it known in the beginning that she was not a fan of the ground assault option. "Sometimes JSOC can be the big gorilla in the room," she said. "I'd rather just push the easy button and bomb it." This was a typical attitude outside of JSOC. There were a lot of haters, not only from the big military side, but also from the agency. Not everyone trusted us because they didn't know us.
"Don't hold back," I said. "Love us or hate us, you're in the circle of trust now. We're all in this together."
"You mean the boys' club," Jen said. "You guys are just showing up for the big game."
She was right. This was her baby. Jen and her team spent 5 years tracking him to get us to where we were now. We were just here to finish the job.
"You guys did all the hard work to get us here," I said. "We're happy to have our 30 minutes of fun and be done."
"I'll admit, you guys aren't what I was expecting at all," she said.
"See, I told you you're in the circle," I said.
It was dark when we landed in Bagram. We taxied to a spot far from the main terminals at the base, the ramp opened, and we saw a C-130 with its ramp down and props turning. Bagram is the main NATO base in northern Afghanistan. A massive base just north of Kabul, it had grown into the size of a small city. Thousands of soldiers and civilian contractors called the base home. Little fighting occurred out of Bagram. In fact, it had gotten so safe that now the only danger was getting a ticket for speeding on the base's streets or for not wearing a reflective belt at night. Spending any time at Bagram would make it tough to keep our secret. Thankfully, we were headed to Jalalabad. The runway there was too small and couldn't handle C-17s. JSOC arranged the C-130 to meet us. We didn't want to risk going to the main Bagram terminal or the chow hall and being seen. A whole troop showing up out of cycle would raise questions.
Gathering our bags and shaking off the Ambien, we walked silently off the back of the C-17 and directly onto the C-130. While we settled onto the orange nylon jump seats that were hung near the front of the plane, Air Force ground crews strapped three of the containers with our gear into the back of the plane. The ramp closed, and we made the one-hour flight to the base in J-Bad. The seats on the C-130 were uncomfortable. If you get stuck in the middle row, you have to rely on the guy behind you to sit up, providing support, or you sink down, crushing your back. If being able to lay out in a hammock in a C-17 was first-class military flying, then the middle seat in a C-130 was economy. Landing in a C-130, even on a paved runway, was jarring. The wheels are close to the fuselage, so it was like landing a roller skate. Plus, it sounded like the plane itself was hitting the tarmac. I held onto the bar as the plane swung around and stopped at the main terminal. The crew chief lowered the gate, revealing buses waiting to take us to the JSOC compound. Jalalabad Airfield is located just a few miles from the Pakistan border. Home to a number of American units, including a force from JSOC, the base is the main staging area for helicopters operating in northeastern Afghanistan. Larger than the smaller outposts that dot the valleys along the border, Jalalabad is part of Regional Command East, and it's from J-Bad that units along the border get supplies and mail. It is home to about 1,500 soldiers, as well as a number of civilian contractors. Afghan security forces help guard the base. The runway splits the base in half. Soldiers live on the south side of the airfield. The JSOC area had its own chow hall, gym, operations center, and a number of plywood huts. The compound was home to Army Rangers, DEVGRU, and support personnel. Almost all of us had double-digit deployments to J-Bad. Walking through the gate, it felt like home. "What's up, brother?" Will said to me when we arrived. He'd already gotten word that he would be part of the raid, and he was eager to get read in on the plan. After putting our gear away, we met back at the fire pit. Guys on previous rotations had built the brick-and-mortar pit, which had become a de facto town square for the compound. Each deployment we added to it until it looked like the patio of a fraternity house. Shitty couches purchased out in town were usually crowded with guys drinking coffee, smoking cigars, or just bullshitting. The couches rotated as often as we did. Made in Pakistan, the cheap stuffing in the cushions couldn't handle our 200-pound frames for long. The SEALs already on their scheduled deployment in Jalalabad got briefed on the plan during our flight over. They heard rumors something was spinning up, but no one knew any details until the brief. Because Will spoke Arabic, he was the only member of his squadron selected to go with us on the assault. The rest of his teammates would be the Quick Reaction Force, or QRF, loaded in two CH-47 helicopters waiting to be called in to help if the team at the compound ran into trouble. They were also tasked to set up a forward air refueling point, FARP, north of the compound. Using the massive CH-47 helicopters, which were basically flying school buses, the QRF would carry inflatable fuel bladders, so the Blackhawks carrying the assault teams could stop for much-needed gas on the return flight to Jalalabad. "You seen the mock-up?" I asked Will. We went into a briefing room near the operations center, and I undid the padlocks. Will helped me lift the wooden cover off. "Wow, this is nice," he said, leaning over it to look closely at the mock-up. Will looked like your average SEAL. He was about 5'10" tall with a lean physique. The thing that made him different was the fact that he had taught himself Arabic. He was extremely smart, professional, and a man of few words. The SEAL teams were a very close-knit community. It felt odd showing up to do this mission when everyone knew the squadron that was already deployed could have pulled it off just as well as we could. The only reason we were tasked with this mission was because we were available to conduct the needed rehearsals to sell the option to the decision-makers at the White House. Every squadron at the command was interchangeable. It came down to being at the right place at the right time. "So, give me the rundown," Will said. "Okay, we're in Chalk 1, I said. "Our bird will be the first to approach from the southeast and hold station here." I pointed at the courtyard. "We'll rope in and clear this building, which we're calling C-1, I said. It was pretty standard stuff, and it didn't take Will long to fall into step. For the next several hours, we went over the whole plan and all the contingencies. I told him about all the rehearsals leading up to this point. This was Will's first taste of the extensive planning the rest of us had been dealing with for weeks. Spending 3 weeks rehearsing for a mission was very odd. Typically, in Afghanistan or Iraq, we would get tasked with a mission, plan it, and launch in a few hours. The headshed, our headquarters staff, continued to work on big-picture planning and coordination. With our gear ready, all we had to do was wait. By rule, most of us had attention deficit disorder, or at least we joked that we did. We could focus on things, but not for long. And waiting was the worst. Walt constantly gave me a hard time. I couldn't even sit through a movie. Like the other guys, we all had our own method to our madness when it came to how we set up our gear. Everything was checked and then rechecked. All of the batteries in my night vision and laser sights were fresh. My radios sat on the charger. Everything was neatly set out in order. Boots and socks next to my folded uniform. My kit, a vest that held two ballistic plates and pouches for ammunition and gear, rested next to my HK416 at the end of my bed. I took my time laying out my gear, but by midnight, or lunchtime for us, we still had hours to kill. During that kind of downtime, we'd go to the gym. Some guys made coffee, but not instant. French press. One guy brought a Pelican case with a press, grinder, and an assortment of coffees that would make Starbucks blush. I'd catch them making the coffee. One cup would take an hour. They'd grind the beans, and then press the coffee. With great care, they'd boil the water, and then sit by the fire and sip the coffee. It was all a part of their ritual, and the time they spent obsessing about the coffee meant fewer minutes to sit and wait. Every one of us had developed some method for killing time. We had 2 days before the mission was scheduled to launch, if it was approved. The next day, I went with Will and two of his teammates over to the hangar to meet the pilots. We had already worked with the air crews from the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment during our rehearsals. We worked with the 160th almost exclusively. In our eyes, they were the best pilots in the world. Teddy, a short, 50-year-old man with close-cropped hair, who was the pilot of Chalk One, met us at the hangar door. We walked around the Black Hawk and showed Will the load plan. Then, before we left, we talked about contingencies. If things go bad and I have to make an emergency landing, I am going to do my best to put her down in that open courtyard to the west, said Teddy. We called it Echo Courtyard, and it was the largest open area on the compound. A seasoned pilot, Teddy knew that if his helicopter was hit by enemy fire or malfunctioned, this courtyard was his best option. Don't worry, though, I said. We've had our share of wrecks. If anyone is going to crash, it'll be Chalk too. I'd never been in a crash, but 7 out of the 12 SEALs on my Chalk had been in some form of crash in the past. Only 2 of the men on Chalk 2's bird could say the same thing. We joked that the law of averages should keep our bird in the air. The window of opportunity to launch was short. The illumination cycle would start increasing the following week. We wouldn't have these types of optimal conditions again for a month. Plus, with everything in place, the longer we held off, the greater the concern that the mission would leak. In the 3 weeks since we started planning, the number of people who knew about the operation had expanded exponentially. JSOC was ramping up its activity. McRaven was in Afghanistan, which isn't news in itself, but the fact that he was heading to JBAD caused a bit of a stir. A Ranger colonel ran daily operations out of our command center in Bagram. Eventually, he was read in on the mission, adding more and more people who knew what was spinning up. Back in Washington, the main concern seemed to be confidence in the intelligence. Unlike Jen, her fellow analysts were only about 60% certain bin Laden lived in the compound. In Afghanistan, we were oblivious to the hand-wringing in Washington. We had daily briefings. Drones flew over the compound, keeping watch. We also had to battle the good idea fairy. She shows up on all our missions to some degree or another, and she isn't our friend. The fairy shows up when the headshed has too much time on their hands. Essentially, officers and planners start dreaming up unrealistic scenarios that we may have to deal with on a mission. They want us to take a bullhorn for crowd control now, the team leader in charge of outer security said. This ranks right up there with the police light. Earlier, the headshed had floated an idea for the outer security team to take one of Bin Laden's cars and affix a police light to it to make the activity around the target look like a police operation. So I said, "Hey, sir, are we just gonna push it out there? We aren't going to have the keys," the team leader said. "What if the steering wheel locks? Plus, which team has time to push a car out of the driveway and all the way down to the street corner? And let's not forget that we will now have a flashing police light highlighting our position." "What color are police lights in Pakistan?" I said. "No idea," he said. That was my next question. Then we got into a half-hour discussion about Ali. Ali was the CIA interpreter on external security. He spoke Pashtun, which was used in the local area. The Good Idea Fairy wants him in local civilian clothes. He's going to be standing between a SAW gunner and me. We're in uniform, so what does it matter? Logic won out in both battles. We didn't carry the police light, and Ali was in uniform. This kind of stuff always happens when planners get into the weeds. The CIA asked us to take a 60-pound box that blocked cell phone signals. Weight was already an issue, so that good idea died quickly. If we had all the time back we wasted fighting the fairy, we might regain a few years of our lives. On the second night, I sat at the fire pit, sipping on some fresh coffee with Charlie and Walt. The debate of the day was over where in the body you should attempt to shoot Bin Laden. "Try not to shoot this motherfucker in the face," Walt said. "Everybody's gonna want to see this picture." "But if it's dark, and I can only see his head, I'm not waiting for a suicide vest," Charlie said. "These will be some of the most viewed pictures of all time," I said. "If given the option, all I'm saying is, shoot for the chest." "Easier said than done," Walt said. "Remember to aim high," I said to Walt, "since you only come up to his nuts." We'd already decided that Elijah Wood had Walt's role in the movie, since he was no taller than a hobbit. Casting the Bin Laden movie was an ongoing joke. Who was going to play whom in Hollywood's version of the mission? No one was getting Brad Pitt or George Clooney. Instead, we had a red-haired guy on the team, so Carrot Top would portray him for sure. At least Walt had Frodo instead of a second-rate comic. "You know, if this goes, we'll get Jay as star," I said. Everyone knew that for the officers like Jay, if the raid was successful, it would be a career-maker. It would most likely mean Jay would make Admiral someday. For the enlisted guys, it really didn't mean anything. To us, it was just another job. "And we'll get Obama re-elected for sure," Walt said. "I can see him now talking about how he killed Bin Laden." We had seen it before when he took credit for the Captain Phillips rescue. Although we applauded the decision-making in this case, there was no doubt in anybody's mind that he would take all the political credit for this, too. We all knew this was bigger than us, and bigger than politics. Maybe the officers and politicians would benefit. But that didn't make us want to do it any less. That was always how things went. Our reward was doing the job, and we wouldn't have it any other way. Near dawn, the fire pit broke up, and we all went and tried to get a few hours of sleep. Since we operated at night, the majority of the population on the JSOC compound slept all day. I popped 2 Ambien. No one was getting any rest without sleeping pills. No matter how much we tried to make this mission just like the others, it wasn't. It had been 2 days, but it felt like months. The third day was supposed to be go day, but cloud cover delayed our launch. No big deal for us. We always get delayed, so we expected it. Getting delayed was better than getting canceled. McCraven wanted to make sure drones could watch the compound in case Bin Laden left while we were en route, and the cloud cover made that impossible. Our daily briefs were held in a long, narrow room with wooden, handmade benches running down the middle like a church. At the front of the room were flat-screen TVs for PowerPoint presentations and to show us drone footage or satellite photos. Today's briefing was standing room only. I was seated next to Charlie near the back on one of the benches. I saw several of the SEALs from the other squadron wedged around the model, which still demanded your attention when you saw it. They were studying it intently before the briefing. It was amazing how it sucked you in, and you'd find yourself fixated on it. A portion of the briefing was about what to do if the mission went drastically wrong, and the Pakistani authorities somehow apprehended us. The president had already given us the green light to protect ourselves, even if we had to engage the Pakistan military. We were going deep into Pakistan, and we needed a reason other than the truth in case we were detained.
Okay, guys, the officer said. Here is what they came up with. We're on a search and recovery mission for a downed ISR platform, he said.
An ISR platform is what the military calls a drone. Essentially, we were going to have to tell the Pakistani interrogators that the United States Air Force lost a drone.
We all laughed.
That is as good as they can come up with, someone said from the back of the room. Why don't they give us a bullhorn and a police siren, just in case?
The story was preposterous. We were allies with Pakistan on paper, so if we did lose a drone, the State Department would negotiate directly with the Pakistani government to get it back. The story didn't wash, and would be very difficult to stick to during hours of questioning.
At least we could laugh at it. Maybe they figured humor would help us endure.
The truth is, if we got to that point, no story we could come up with was going to cover up 22 SEALs packing 60 pounds of high-tech gear on their backs, an EOD tech, and an interpreter for a total of 24 men, plus a dog, raiding a suburban neighborhood a few miles from the Pakistani Military Academy. At the end of the briefing, the commanding officer of DEVGRU came walking in. A captain with silver hair and a mustache, he'd lost his leg in a parachute accident years ago. As he walked to the front of the conference room, I barely noticed the slight hitch in his step from the prosthetic limb. The officer briefing us faded into the background as the commander got to the front. All of the laughing and grumbling about the cover story receded, and the room was silent.
Okay, guys, the DEVGRU commander said. Just got off the phone with McCraven. He just talked to the president. The operation has been approved. We're launching tomorrow night.
There were no cheers or high fives. I glanced back at some of the fellas sitting on the benches around me, the guys I'd operated side by side with for years.
Holy shit, I thought. I didn't think it was really going to happen. No more briefs, no more good idea fairy, and most of all, there was no more waiting.
Chapter 12. Go Day.
I couldn't sleep. I spent the last couple of hours trying to get comfortable, but I found no peace on the hard mattress or in my own head. It was go day, and there was no getting around the significance of the mission now. Sliding open the camouflage poncho liner hung over my bunk to shield the light, I swung my legs out and rubbed my eyes. After 3 days of trying not to think about the mission, it was impossible to keep it from my mind now. If everything went as planned, in less than 12 hours, we'd be roping into Bin Laden's compound in Pakistan. I didn't feel tired. The only evidence I'd slept was the empty baggie that once held a couple of Ambien and a handful of empty bottles now filled with urine. Since we lived in overflow housing, it was a 200-yard walk to the nearest bathroom, so I saved my empty water or Gatorade bottles to piss in instead. Standard practice. We'd flip on our headlamps and relieve ourselves without ever truly waking up. I felt fresh physically, but mentally I was amped up. Not on edge, but restless. The hurry-up-and-wait routine was grating on my nerves. We were all just happy the wait was almost over. Careful to be quiet, since some of my teammates were still sound asleep, I slid from the bunk and got dressed. I could hear the faint snores of the others in their rooms. Grabbing my sunglasses, I walked out of the hut and into the daylight. The sun hit me like a sledgehammer. It felt like walking out of a casino in Vegas after playing all night. It took me a second to adjust. But soon the late afternoon sun felt good on my face and arms as I started walking toward the chow hall. I looked at my watch. For those of us on the compound on vampire hours, it was morning. For the rest of the base, it was the middle of the workday. The constant roar of helicopters provided the soundtrack. As I walked, a shit-sucking truck passed by after cleaning a bank of porta-johns on the camp. The pungent chemical smell of the disinfectant hung in the air as it passed. I kept my head down and walked on the gravel that kept the dust down. Each unit changed the combination on the gate when they arrived. I fished a slip of paper out of my pocket with the code. My head was still cloudy from the Ambien. Pressing the numbers, I tried the doorknob. No luck. It took me 3 tries to get out, but I was finally on my way. Just get through breakfast, I thought. I was back to surviving Green Team. I knew if you focused on the whole thing, you cracked. The only way to survive was getting through the day one meal at a time. Now, hours before the biggest mission of my career, I was just focused on getting to breakfast. It was success, one step at a time. Inside the chow hall, I washed my hands under a blast of cold water. The stench of greasy, fried cafeteria food was so thick it clung to your clothes. The chow hall still had old holiday decorations pasted on the concrete wall. A long, faded 1970s poster of the four food groups took up most of the bulletin board next to the menu of the day. I surveyed the long, stainless steel buffets. Behind each one, in an apron and hat, was a civilian contractor, ready to serve me a scoop of grits or pile bacon on my plate. Nothing looked good. The bacon was more fat than meat, and soggy from the grease. But I needed energy. I headed straight for the grill, where a small line was formed. A short-order cook was poised behind the flat top. Scooping up a buttery omelet folded into a greasy mess, he slid it on the plate of the guy in front of me. "Four eggs," I said, as the cook looked at me. "Scramble, please. Ham and cheese." While the cook started on my eggs, I got some toast and fruit. The selection was the same on every deployment. Large trays of unripe dark orange cantaloupe and honeydew with an almost chemical green color. During my last rotation, I had seen a box in the chow hall marked for military or prison use only. Seemed about right. No one joins the military for the food. I grabbed two pieces of bread and ran them through the restaurant-grade toaster and piled some pineapple onto my plate. You can't screw up pineapple. Back at the grill, I picked up my eggs and stopped to scoop some oatmeal and raisins into a bowl. I surveyed the tables arranged in long rows in the dining area. The murmur of conversations, coupled with the big-screen TV tucked into the corner, tuned to cable news, created a dull roar. I saw a few of my teammates at a table far from the TV and dropped off my tray on my way to get coffee. The chow hall was for JSOC personnel only, but not everyone knew about the mission. As I sprinkled some pepper on my eggs, I muttered a hello to my teammates, including Charlie and Tom. They returned the greeting, but like me, no one wanted to talk. We were more comfortable alone with our thoughts. "How did you sleep?" I said.
"Like shit," Charlie said.
"You take any Ambien?"
"2," he said.
"Look at the bright side. At least we're enjoying this glorious breakfast. It's like the buffet at Hotel Del Coronado."
The hotel was one of the oldest resorts on the Pacific coast, not far from where we'd all gone through buds.
"Right," Charlie said. "Is that all you can come up with?" I was trying to be funny, but it was too early. Charlie always gave me shit about my weak jokes. I knew they sucked, but it was part of the fun. Beyond that, there was no talk of home, no talk of the mission. There was nothing more to cover. The food wasn't good, but you wouldn't have known by looking at our plates when we were through. I doubt any of us really tasted breakfast. It was just fuel for later. After my eggs and fruit, I forced down the bowl of oatmeal and finished a glass of orange juice. Walking back to my room, I was stuffed. I didn't know when I'd eat next. The rooms were still quiet when I got back. Some of my teammates were trying to sleep until the last minute, but I was too amped. Getting my toothbrush and a bottle of water, careful not to grab my piss bottle, I walked out to a thick gravel area off to the side and brushed my teeth and spit on the ground. Breakfast. Check. Brushed my teeth. Check. Back in my room, I stuffed my toothbrush back into my backpack. I'd already laid out my Cry Precision Desert Digital Combat uniform. Designed like a long-sleeve shirt and cargo pants, the uniform had 10 pockets, each with a specific purpose. The shirt was designed to wear under body armor. The sleeves and shoulders were camouflaged, but the body of the shirt was tan and made of a lightweight material that wicked sweat away. I'd chopped the sleeves off of my shirt because it was hot. Sitting on my bed, I started to get dressed. Nothing I did, from the moment I started putting on my pants, was random. Every step was carefully planned. Every check was a way to focus and make sure I didn't forget anything. These were the same steps I did before every mission. Before I slid my pants on, I rechecked each pocket on my uniform. In one cargo pocket, I had my assault gloves and leather mitts for fast roping. The other cargo pocket had an assortment of extra batteries, an energy gel, and 2 power bars. My right ankle pocket had an extra tourniquet and my left one had rubber gloves and my SSE kit. In a pocket on my left shoulder, I felt the $200 cash I'd use if we got compromised and I needed to buy a ride or bribe someone. Evasion takes money, and few things work better than American cash. My camera, a digital Olympus point-and-shoot, was in my right shoulder pocket. Running along the back of my belt, I had a Daniel Winkler fixed-blade knife. I tucked my shirt in and picked up my kit and inspected it again. The ceramic plates covered my vital organs in the front and back. I had two radios mounted on either side of the front plate. Between the radios, I carried three magazines for my H&K 416 assault rifle and one baseball-sized fragmentation hand grenade. I also had several chemical lights rigged at the front of my vest, including the infrared version that can only be seen using night vision. We'd crack the plastic lights and throw them in front of rooms and areas that we had cleared. The lights were invisible to the naked eye, but my teammates could see them through their night vision and know what areas were secure. My bolt cutters rode in a pouch on my back, with the two handles sticking a little ways above my shoulder. Attached to my vest were the two antennas for the radios. Running my hands over my kit, I tugged on the breaching charge I rubber-banded to the back of it. I next focused on my helmet. It weighed less than 10 pounds, with the night vision goggles attached. It could officially stop a 9mm round, but in the past, the helmets had stopped AK-47 bullets. I switched on the light attached to the rail system that runs down the side of the helmet. It was a brand new Princeton Tech charge light. I'd used it in my last deployment. I set the helmet on my head and pulled down my night vision goggles, or NVGs. Unlike some of the conventional units, we had NVGs with four tubes instead of the usual two. This allowed us a field of view of 120 degrees instead of just 40 degrees. The standard goggles were like looking through toilet paper tubes. Our NVGs allowed us to clear corners more easily and gave us greater situational awareness. Switching on the $65,000 goggles, my room was bathed in a green hue. With a few adjustments, I could see the furniture in crisp detail. Finally, I picked up my rifle. Pulling it into my shoulder, I turned on my EOTech sight. Mounted behind it was a 3x magnifier, which allowed me to shoot more accurately during the day. Aiming at the wall near my bunk, I tested my red laser, which was visible to the naked eye, and I flipped down my NVGs and tested the IR laser. Pulling the bolt back, I chambered a round. I performed a press check by sliding the bolt back and inspecting the chamber to make sure a round was seated. I double-checked to make sure it was on safe, and I rested the rifle back against the wall. With my gear checked and ready, I pulled a small laminated booklet, our cheat sheet for the mission, out of a small pouch in the front of my vest, and flipped through it again. The first page was a mini-grid reference guide, or GRG. It was an aerial image of the compound, with all of the main areas labeled and the buildings numbered. Everyone worked off the same GRG, from the pilots to the QRF to the people in the operations center. There was a list of radio frequencies on the following page. The last section had a list of the names and photos of everyone expected on the target. I studied the pictures of the Al-Kuwaiti brothers, spending extra time on Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti since he was thought to be living in C1. Each page not only had pictures, but also vital stats like height, weight, and any known aliases. The final page had a picture of bin Laden, and several renderings of what he and his son could look like now. With my camouflage uniform on and my gear ready to go, I grabbed my Salomon Quest boots and pulled them on. They were a little bulkier than the low-top trail running shoes my teammates sometimes wore. I swore by these boots because they protected my baby ankles, which I twisted with great frequency. I had climbed the mountains in Kunar province and patrolled through the deserts of Iraq in these boots. All of my gear was proven and had been vetted on previous missions. I knew it all worked. It finally hit me as I laced up my boots. This could be my last time doing it. What we were about to do was significant. We'd fought hard to keep history out of our minds. We were doing our jobs, and this was just the next mission. The task was to assault a house and capture or kill a target. It didn't matter to me who it was supposed to be. But as I tied my laces, it struck me that maybe it did matter. There was no escaping the significance, and I wanted to make sure the laces
didn't come undone.
For the last hour, I'd considered the smallest tasks. Everything had to be perfect. I tied the loops of my laces down in a double knot and tucked them into my boot top. In the middle of the room, I hoisted my 60-pound vest over my head and let it rest on my shoulders. I tightened the straps, basically sealing myself in between the plates. I took a second to make sure I could get to everything. Reaching above my head, I could grab both handles of the bolt cutters. I touched the breaching charge over my left shoulder. I connected the antennas to my radios and put on my bone phones, which sat on my cheekbones. These would allow me to hear any radio traffic through bone conduction technology. If I needed, I could also put in an earbud to cancel out the ambient noise and allow sound to travel directly into my ear canal. In my right ear, I would hear the troop net. On the troop net, I would hear all of my teammates communicating with each other. My left ear would monitor the command net, which would let me communicate with the other team leaders and the headshed. As a team leader, I'd need the two separate nets, but the reality was there wasn't going to be much traffic on the command net for this objective. Only the officers were going to be talking on the satellite radios, and most of the radio traffic on the target would be through the troop net. All of my checks were done. I'd completed my steps to prepare for the mission. I took one last look in the room to make sure I didn't forget anything, and headed out the door. The sun was setting. Around me, I could hear the others getting ready, too. There was little talking, but you could hear guys moving around, checking their equipment or packing up their bags. The door to the building banged against the doorframe with a steady rhythm as guys moved in and out. We were set to muster at the fire pit in a few minutes. As I got closer, I could hear the thundering beat of a metal band blaring out of some speakers. I met up with my team, and we found a spot and waited for McCraven to show up. He'd requested some time to talk with us before the mission. "You ready?" I asked Will. He nodded. Looking around, I could see Walt, Charlie, and the others waiting with their own teams. Only hours before, we'd been hanging out and laughing about who would play us in the movie. Now, everyone was serious. McCraven showed up with little fanfare. As he walked up, we all gathered around. His speech focused on the strategic level, something he was more comfortable talking about. Nothing he said really stuck with me, as my mind was focused on what was about to happen. As he left, word was passed to move out. "Everybody on the Blackhawks, take buses 1 and 2, I heard one of the support guys yell. "Buses 3 and 4 are going to be the 47s. The buses were lined up and already running. On board, I wedged myself into a seat near the middle. Will crammed in next to me. The buses were old and dusty. The vinyl seats were worn from years of transporting assaulters in full gear to the flight line. The bus didn't drive as much as it ambled. The shocks were worn from carrying all the extra weight, so every bump shot through our legs and backs. The ride only took a few minutes, but it felt much longer. After a while, I could see massive spotlights set up, facing outward near the hangar, where I knew the Blackhawks waited for us. It looked like a star exploded, and it was impossible to see inside the globe of light. A generator hummed in the background as we got off and walked behind a fence that surrounded the hangar. Inside, the helicopter crews were making final checks. The noise from the rotors made conversation impossible. I snuck off to the fence to take one last leak. When the helicopters were ready, I saw some of the support crew push open the gate, and the helicopters rolled out. I nodded to a few guys on Chalk 2, flashing them the middle finger with a smile. We separated in silence. Anything said was lost in the rotor wash, but the gestures all said the same thing. "See you on the ground." There was nothing more to say. We formed up on either side of the helicopters. I looked at my watch. We had 10 minutes. I found a spot by the tarmac to lie down. I rested my head on my helmet and looked at the stars. For a second, I just relaxed. Finally, the crew chief signaled us to load up. I was one of the last to get on board, since I would be the first one down the rope. After everyone else had loaded up, there was a small spot by the door next to Walt and the sniper who would cover us as we fast-roped down. Wedging my ass in as best I could, it was already cramped. I checked my weapon to make sure it was on safe. When you're crammed into a helicopter with little room to move, the last thing you need is for your weapon's safety to get kicked off inadvertently. I cradled my helmet in my lap to make sure my night vision goggles didn't get damaged. Flipped up, they looked like antlers on the helmet.
Once the door clicked shut, the helicopter picked up and hovered for a few seconds before setting back down. Then, right on schedule, the helicopter leapt from the tarmac. I could feel the nose dip down as we picked up speed. Once we cleared the airfield, the Black Hawk banked to the right and headed for the border. The cabin was dark and crowded. I could feel Walt's knees dig into my back when he moved. The radio in my ear was silent. I could see a faint glow from the controls in the cockpit, but nothing outside the window. It was pitch black. About 15 minutes into the flight, the first message crackled over the troop net. Crossing the border. I guess we're actually doing this, I thought. Soon my head was bobbing as I dozed. As we got closer to Abbottabad, I could hear the pro words for the different checkpoints come over the troop net, but each time I slipped back to a light sleep. 10 minutes. That shook me from my daze. I wiped my eyes and wiggled my toes to start working the circulation back. I must have slept more than I thought, since the 10-minute call seemed to come quickly. I think most of the guys on the helicopter actually caught some much-needed sleep on the ride in. 6 minutes. All the hype was gone, and it was just another night at work for us. I pulled on my helmet and snapped the chin strap closed. Pulling my NVGs down over my eyes, I made sure everything was in focus. I pulled the gun tightly to my chest so it didn't get hung up when I roped out, and checked the safety one last time. It was still dark in the cabin, but I knew everyone else was making the same checks. 1 minute. The crew chief slid the door open. I slid the fast rope insertion extraction system, Fry's bar, into place. The fast rope was connected to the Fry's bar, which allowed it to fall cleanly to the ground. The bar was held in place with a pin at its base. I ran my hand along the bar and made sure the pin was seated. The crew chief checked it as well. I gave the rope a hard tug to make sure it was secure, and then slid my legs out over the edge of the helicopter and into the breeze. I grabbed the rope and tried to lean out far enough to see ahead of us. Several of the houses we passed over had lighted pools and manicured gardens behind tall stone walls. I was used to seeing mountains or villages made up of clusters of mud huts. From above, Abbottabad reminded me of flying over the suburbs in the United States. I leaned out the door and finally caught a glimpse of the compound. The flight from Jalalabad had taken about 90 minutes, and we would be arriving well after midnight. It was pitch black, and none of the lights in the surrounding houses were on. It seemed like the whole block was without power. Rolling blackouts in the area were common. The engine noise changed as the helicopter started to hover. Once over the predetermined fast rope point, I could throw the rope. The hover was rough, and it was apparent the pilots were having trouble holding station. It felt like they were wrestling the helicopter, trying to force it to cooperate. My eyes flicked from the ground to the crew chief waiting for the helicopter to get into position so I could throw the rope. Go, 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 ran in a loop in my head. The pilots never had an issue holding a hover during rehearsals. Something was wrong. We all desperately wanted out of the helicopter and onto the ground. We're going around, I heard over the troop net. Shit, I thought. We haven't gotten on the ground yet, and we are already going to plan B. Suddenly the helicopter kicked to the right 90 degrees, and I could feel my stomach drop like riding a roller coaster. The rotors above me screamed as the Black Hawk tried to claw its way back into the air. With each second, the helicopter slipped closer toward the earth. From my side of the helicopter, I could see the compound rushing up at us through the open door. I struggled to find a handhold and slide back into the cabin. There was little room behind me as all my teammates had pushed forward, prepping to fast rope. Then I felt Walt's hand grab my gear and pull me deeper into the cabin. His other hand shot out and grabbed the sniper next to me. I leaned back with all my strength. My legs kicked the air as I tried to get them inside. I knew if my legs were exposed when we hit, they would get pinned or cut off. The closer we got to the ground, the angrier I became. Each and every assaulter had sacrificed so much throughout their individual careers to get to this point. We all felt extremely lucky to have been chosen for this mission, and now we were about to die without even getting a chance to do our part. Fuck, 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 I thought. This is gonna hurt. Chapter 13. Infill. My body was tense and my abs screamed as I tried to fold my legs into my chest. All I could see was the ground coming up at me through the large open door. Helicopters are not like airplanes that can glide in for a crash landing. When helicopters stop working, They fall out of the sky like a rock. When they hit, rotor blades snap off, sending shrapnel and debris in all directions. Sitting in the open door, I feared the cabin would roll, crushing me underneath. I could feel Walt tugging on my kit, pulling me back inside the cabin.